Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. It's a show where we investigate why people behave the way they do. But there's some perspectives we don't often hear about, like what makes people cross the line into criminal behavior?
Are they evil or are they damaged? Are they both?
Join me for Criminal Psychology, a special series diving into some of these questions. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Police searched for Rajwinder Singh in India for years, and then one day they got a tip-off and finally made a surprise arrest at a Sikh temple. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Welcome to the case of Toya's murder.
The body of Toya Cordingley was found at Wangetti Beach, north of Cairns.
Her face adorns billboards and stickers across the region.
Searching for clues in the murder of the 24-year-old pharmacy worker.
Alongside the idyllic and isolated beaches.
This should not happen to a young woman out there walking her dog on a Sunday.
We're nearing the end of the third week, what was set down as a three-week trial, and the ABC's Far North reporter Chris Tester has been in court that whole time. Chris, can you wrap up the last couple of days for us in 60 seconds or so?
Yeah, Stocky, we've been taken to the Sikh temple in New Delhi where Indian police pounced on Rajwinder Singh 4 years after Toya Cordingley's death, and we heard evidence about how that search for him in India unfolded. There's also been evidence about the forensic examination of his blue Alfa Romeo, which is what led to police first investigating Rajwinder Singh way back in November 2018, about 3 weeks after Toya died. And we've heard evidence from locals in the Wangetti community who've told the court what they were up to that afternoon and about some of the people that they'd seen in the area.
Thank you, Chris. There's been a cast of very North Queensland characters come to the fore over the last few days. And as you mentioned, a lot of other stuff to talk about in this episode. But really, the thing I'm very keen to talk about and get into first is this insight we got into Rajwinder Singh's kind of movements in India. And, you know, basically the kind of the search that was going on for him for years, right?
That's right. The court's heard that Rajwinder Singh first came to police attention through that blue Alfa Romeo car matching the pings of Toya Cordingley's phone on the afternoon she died in an apparent direction away from the beach. And that happened about 3 weeks after she died. And they'd already done investigations, which we'll get to a little bit later. So November 2018, they've essentially found out that there's this guy called Rajwinder Singh, owned a blue Alfa Romeo, and they had reason to believe that perhaps he was in the Wangetti area at the time. They found out that he had travelled to India the day Toya Cordingley's body was found. He booked this one-way flight, and on the 23rd of October 2018, he actually left for New Delhi via Sydney. So we heard evidence from Detective Superintendent Murray Taylor, who was actually the Australian Federal Police's man in India based at the High Commission in New Delhi. And his job involved liaising and working with Indian police and law enforcement officials, particularly those who are responsible for Interpol and international policing in India. So he first heard in November 2018 that Queensland police were interested in finding out where Rajwinder Singh was in India.
Yeah, and we got this kind of look into how he went about that. And he was talking about kind of the officers he was talking to there. I think he even went as far as kind of talking to police in kind of Rajwinder Singh's like area, like the villages he was from, right?
Yeah, there were a few agencies he spoke to over different meetings at different periods of time. That was from, for example, the Deputy Inspector General of the Central Bureau of Investigation, which is the CBI in India. That's kind of a national policing agency that does all the Interpol stuff. But yeah, he also travelled to northern India, to the Punjab region, where Rajwinder Singh's family is from. And we heard there he met with senior figures from the Punjab police and also the Amritsar Police District as well.
Yeah, and I mean, this went on for a few years. You know, he's hearing about this in late 2018. He doesn't seem to be making much progress outside of all of these conversations. And then there was talk of a reward or something?
That's right. We heard that on the 3rd of November 2022, a reward was posted for information that might reveal where Rajwinder Singh was. And information about this reward was posted in a few places, on the High Commission's website and on social media. And then the next day, it received significant publicity in Indian media.
Mm. And what happens from there?
Well, Nathan Crane has asked about whether there'd been much media about Rajwinder Singh to this point, and Detective Superintendent Taylor said, no, not in India. And it only takes about 3 weeks. On the 24th of November 2022, Detective Superintendent Taylor says he's received some information that Rajwinder Singh is to be at a particular location. It's a Sikh Gurdwara, a place of worship in northern New Delhi.
And this starts setting in motion the vehicle for his arrest.
That's right. So about a dozen Indian police are at this Sikh Gurdwara, and they're waiting for Rajwinder Singh to arrive. He's arrested at 5 minutes to 6 the following morning, so the morning of November 25th, 2022. This is less than a month after the reward, and this information about the reward was publicised in India. And it sets in motion Rajwinder Singh's return to Australia. We've heard, of course, that there had been an extradition request formally made by Australian authorities back in 2021, but by January 2023, after he's been arrested by Indian police, Indian authorities approved that extradition request. It's an agreed fact between the Crown and the defence that Rajwinder Singh consented to his extradition. He didn't fight it. Mm. He agreed to return to Australia, and then in February 2023, he's returned back to Australia in the custody of police.
Yeah, wow. It all unfolds really quickly. This search for years for Rajwinder Singh, you know, this starting in late 2018, basically, not much happening over that period of time, over a course of years, and then this reward, and then this kind of flurry of activity to bring him back. So, kind of incredible, Chris, to kind of hear how all that unfolded and the story around that. As well as that story, we've also kind of been diving into the kind of forensic examination that police did on Rajwinder Singh's Blue Alfa Romeo. What did they find in the car?
That's right. So remember, this is the Blue Alfa Romeo that Rajwinder Singh, the courts heard, left at his friend Rajkaran Singh's house. So he got his mate Rajkaran, a fellow nurse, to drive him to Cairns Airport the day he left, and the Blue Alfa Romeo was left in front of Rajkaran's house. So when Rajwinder Singh hasn't returned and isn't contactable, Rajkaran has called the police. And at some point in November 2018, police have gone to that house and taken the car for forensic examination. And we heard evidence from a couple of police forensic scientists with several years' experience about, things that they observed and tests that they did. The outside of the car was kind of described as not having been washed in recent times. We heard evidence from Sergeant Amanda Milligan. She was one of those forensic scientists. She found sand scattered throughout the car, and we saw photos that were actually shown to the court. It wasn't doused in sand, but you can kind of see smatterings of sand in various places. Some of that sand from, for example, a rear mat and the center console was actually taken for sampling. And we heard evidence that while there were two rear floor mats, the two front ones were missing.
Was it just Rajwinder Singh's car that she looked at, or were there other cars that she had looked at as well?
There are other cars that she looked at as well. So she actually looked at Marco Heidenreich's car. He's the partner of Toy Accordingly. That work was done essentially a couple of days after the alleged murder at Wongeti Beach. She found a couple of spots on the front of his car that tested, they do a presumptive test for blood. So we've heard that these kind of Comber-Roach tests can return false results if, for example, there's things like animal blood or pet food. And she determined that these spots that kind of flared up were actually insects. Mm. And there was no blood on the inside of his car. And then, interestingly, there was also no blood found in Rajwinder Singh's car either. They did another forensic scientist gave evidence about doing a test with luminol on various parts of the car, the dash, the roof, the interior, the seats. There were a couple of spots that returned presumptive results for blood using that other test I mentioned, the Comber-Roach. So one was on the the back driver's side, the underside of the door handle, and one was on a tissue box. But the luminol testing throughout the interior did not return any evidence of blood.
Yep. Thank you, Chris. We've also heard from this kind of cast of North Queensland characters, people who are living around this beach. And one of the things that we've heard from the defence early on is that they were going to present these kind of other people who were around the beach that they don't think were kind of followed up, basically, by police. And we heard from a whole bunch of witnesses around this. I mean, I think there was like a dozen people or so. But by my account, Chris, they all seem to revolve around the movements of kind of a few key people. That is Remy Fry, Matty Hollins and Evan McRae. Have I got that right?
That's right, yeah. Remy Fry was a... his mum lived in Wongeti, and we heard that he was visiting her and some friends there that day. Matty Hollins is a Wongeti local, lives with his mother in that area, and was checking some crab pots not too far from Wongeti Beach the afternoon Ms. Cordingley died. And Evan McRae lives in Cairns, but we heard questions asked of him about whether he used to go pig hunting at Wongeti Beach. And a bit of evidence around some text messages that he'd sent in the days leading up to Toy Cordingley's murder.
Yeah, I mean, the name Evan McRae, I kind of recognised when he started giving evidence. And it took me a little while to realise that he was the person that the defence mentioned in their opening, talking about other people around the beach and that he'd sent, I think, his wife at the time, or, you know, soon to be sort of estranged wife at the time, a message saying that he was, you know, pretty upset, hated people, and needed to, you know, go pigging to kill something. I think that kind of stuck with me. And, you know, we heard a lot about his kind of life around this time, what he was doing, you know, if he was at the beach, all that stuff, right?
Yeah, he was asked questions dating back to the 90s about incidents he'd been involved with, violent incidents. Greg Maguire, the defence counsel. Yeah, it was a real interrogation at the witness box. Mm. Essentially, all of Evan McRae's dirty laundry was put to him. A lot of things he said he couldn't actually recall, so I guess those aspects aren't evidence. But he agreed that he had some issues with anger. He told the court that he was quite frustrated and sad and receiving treatment at the time, back in 2018, for depression. We heard he was going through a marriage breakdown. And then we got to these questions about his former pig hunting days. We heard that, you know, when he was younger, in his 20s, he used to go pig hunting. He was asked, you know, about how he did that, what kind of tools he would use, the use of dogs. It was quite a difficult watch. I mean, to get to the extent of the questioning about Evan McRae's background, he was actually asked about a time in 2014 when he stole a couple of boxes of Huggies nappies. These are the kind of questions that were being put to Evan McRae. Mm. We heard text messages that he'd sent his estranged wife, Paula, at the time. She was kind of involved in him coming to police attention because there was an article in the Cairns Post newspaper about a public masturbator on Wongeti Beach. She called Crime Stoppers. She kind of said to him he'd left his contact details on the car of a woman at a beach around this time, and she'd also told him, look, you better call them as well. We've heard that he was a nudist, displayed this concerning behaviour, had been involved in road rage incidents.
Mm, yeah, and we also heard from the police officer who kind of looked into Evan McRae and heard that they didn't search his house or anything like that. How come?
Well, that's because we heard that they were passing information about people up to an information centre. Kind of all the detectives were pooling their information together. And based on evidence like phone records and traffic camera footage, some of this was displayed to the court, by the way, or has been during the trial. We've seen evidence that around... just before 5:30 that afternoon, Evan McRae was actually driving north, kind of from the Cairns suburbs, to a shopping centre to withdraw money from an ATM. We'd have evidence from his mum who came to court and told the court that, you know, she believes he was at home all day with her. They'd gone out to buy a birthday present for a kid's birthday party at one point in the morning. And based on that, the police didn't suspect him of an offence, so they didn't, they didn't seize any knives or search his car.
Right, okay. The other person we heard a bit about was Remy Fry. He was the bloke who was visiting his mum near Wongeti that day. What was he up to?
Yeah, he was visiting his mum. We heard that he works as a school teacher and lived at Kuranda, which, if you don't know Cairns, Kuranda is about 40 minutes away from Wongeti, kind of on the hill, up the range, popular tourist destination. So he described, you know, his typical kind of Sunday, you know, weekend routine. He would go back to Wangetti where his mum lived and where he'd grown up, and, you know, he'd visit her, and then he'd go down the road to visit some friends. And he more or less said this is what he did that day. Now, interestingly enough, one of the friends came to court and gave evidence because he'd told police shortly after that he couldn't recall seeing Remy Fry that day. Remy Fry's mum said, yep, he came to my place. He would have stayed about this long. He would have gone to his mate's house and then he would have come back. And the defence kind of cross-examined, you know, both people on this. Well, you know, to the mum, well, you know, do you believe this is what he did just because he said it? And his mum, Christine, said, no, I know that's what he did because that's what he always did. And interestingly, his friend Peter Lincoln, the one who told police that he couldn't remember seeing him there that day, he said, look, I was actually focused on looking after my kid that afternoon. We heard that he had a young son with him, and the presence of Remy Fry wasn't something that he felt that he needed to remember. So he's told police at the time, oh, I don't remember seeing Remy Fry that day. And he's come to court now and said, well, you know, actually, I'm not actually sure what I saw. It wasn't a detail I felt important to remember.
Yeah. And then Matty Hollins, another one of these people that lives, you know, around this Wangetti area. And his day sounds almost exactly like, I imagine, someone who lives in a kind of remote part of North Queensland, mostly sitting around playing PlayStation in between checking crab pots.
That's right. We heard, you might recall, the jury went to Wangetti Beach, and we've heard a bit of evidence in this trial about these bush tracks and kind of that dense mangrove environment that's between, you know, the highway and the beach. And Matty Hollins kind of took us to a bit of this because he described kind of checking his crab pots three times that day. You know, you do it at different times of the day, every few hours. And I guess the critical time he checked his crab pots that was relevant at this trial was around about 4:30 or after 4 o'clock. And he said that, you know, he would usually carry a knife when he did this because you're wading at one point generally through this creek, and he described it as sort of being waist-deep water. And he said that, you know, he was actually specifically asked, why did you carry a knife on this occasion? And he said that he'd been going through there and seen this dirty big black croc about 3 metres as he's wading through the water. And he said it's something you do quickly. And he was describing carrying this knife for protection. Now, interestingly, all these men that I've discussed and others who gave evidence who live at Wangetti, Evan McRae as well, Remy Fry, they were all asked to give DNA. And we heard evidence that they all gave DNA samples voluntarily. And some of them, actually, the ones who lived in the Wangetti area were actually asked by police, and this is October 31st, so about 10 days after Toya Cordingley's died, you know, to hand over any knives for forensic testing. And both Matty Hollins and a mate, Lee Moran, who also lived there, they both said, yep, we handed our knives over. In Matty Hollins' case, that was 15 knives. He was a professional fisherman.
Yep.
And all those were forensically examined. Now, the extent that police went to looking into, I guess, people's versions here was shown to the court in this case through a PlayStation message, because Matty Hollins, as you mentioned, had said he'd been playing PlayStation with his brother online. His brother was living in Cairns, and he actually sent his brother a message on the PlayStation chat feature at 4:04 that afternoon saying, oh, you know, running short on time, I've got to go check my crab pots and then pick up my other brother from the airport. And we heard evidence that about, you know, 5:30-ish, he and his mate Lee Moran headed down to Cairns, picked the brother up from the airport, and then went home, stopping to pick up a pizza on the way.
Yeah. And that time's important, Chris, that 4 p.m. time, because police believe that's about the time that Toya Cordingley was murdered, right?
Yeah, we've heard that the phone, Toya Cordingley's phone, was pinging away from Wangetti Beach, kind of through that northwestern Cairns area between 4:51 p.m. and 5:17 p.m. She'd sent a text message to her boyfriend, Marco Heidenreich, at 3:17 p.m. So there's kind of that window there, I guess, of roughly an hour and a half where the Crown would allege that this happened in.
Yeah. And, I mean, Chris, you're talking about we've got Matty Hollins and the PlayStation message. We heard from Matty Hollins' brother, Jordan Hollins, and I actually felt quite bad for Jordan because He says as he's getting up into the witness box, I'm really nervous. And, you know, I kind of feel for someone in this position because you're giving evidence about your brother. You're in a court. It's a really formal place. He's talking about how nervous he is. And he gets up there. He's sworn in. He's asked who his mum is. He asked if he spoke to his brother. He says, yeah, I sent him a message asking if he wanted to play PlayStation. And then that was it. He was done. Straight down. 2-minute witness. Happened so quickly. I mean, Chris, what was the defence trying to show us with these people and this kind of vignette of North Queensland life?
Well, we heard in the defence opening that, you know, that they believe that the injuries that Toy accordingly sustained were so severe, you know, describing that really deep cut to the neck. In Greg Maguire's words, it would have probably been done by someone on drugs or a crazy person. I guess they're just trying to show that there are, you know, numerous people in the Wangetti area who own knives. It's a place where people go pig hunting. They carry knives. Interestingly, one of the witnesses who was called was Jesse Hollins, the brother who was being picked up by Maddie Hollins from the airport that night. So he wasn't at Wangetti at the time that Toy accordingly was killed, but he was asked about his girlfriend because he told police that his girlfriend was a little bit creeped out by Wangetti Beach, and the defence was asking, you know, what did she mean by that? And he said, oh, look, it was just a general comment she made. He didn't read too much into it. Lee Moran, the other local, was asked about, you know, seeing nudists and people milling around pig hunting in that kind of bush area. Maddie Hollins, whose real name is Cohen, by the way, he goes by Maddie Hollins, he told the court that these tracks are generally used by locals, not so much visitors. He said that kind of the place where people fish and check their crab pots, you don't actually have to go all the way down to the beach. He said that these are kind of more frequented by locals. His walk to check the crab pots doesn't take him all the way down to the beach. So we get a bit of a sense of, I guess, the terrain here and, you know, the types of people who are using these areas.
I mean, I really kind of, this whole group of people really took me to North Queensland as we were hearing from them all. And yeah, they kind of, their routines, the crab pots, the kind of walking between houses, the tracks through the bush and all of that. Chris, I do want to jump into some questions. We get a heap of questions from people here. thecaselaw@abc.net.au is our email address, and we're loving all the emails you're sending through to us. I want to start with one today from Louise. Louise writes, thanks guys, an interesting podcast. I remember this case very well. You mentioned in your last episode that Rajwinder Singh phoned his cousin in Sydney from the airport, but he didn't give a statement. Is it optional for someone connected with the accused?
We didn't get an explanation for that, Louise. It was just mentioned that, yeah, he phoned his cousin Gulal Singh and New South Wales police went and spoke to him. And then Gulal Singh didn't make a statement. And that was the extent that the courts heard. So beyond that, I can't really add a whole lot.
No, that's all right. Thank you, Chris. Thank you for the question, Louise. It's a great question. And sometimes there's things we can't answer, but, you know, we'll be open about that when we can. So great question. Another one here, Chris, from Kylie in Melbourne. Kylie writes, hi, Stocky and Chris. Loving your work. Also very much looking forward to hearing the parts that you aren't allowed to tell us because I feel like there's much more to it. Kylie, you don't know the half of it. There's a whole section missing from today's episode because of some legal discussion yesterday morning. But again, that is for another time. Kylie continues, my question, I think I have missed something. Where did they find Toya's phone? All of this talk about it pinging at various mobile towers, I assume that means they found her phone somewhere.
Yeah, it doesn't, Kylie. Actually, the information about it pinging the mobile phone towers comes from Telstra records. So we've heard evidence in this trial about call charge records that police obtained from telcos for various people's phones and also the timing advance data. So essentially, they get the number of a phone and the number of a handset, and they can request from the telcos. That information gets downloaded and provided to the police, and then it's shown to the court in like a table, all the data kind of laid out. So the times that various things happened, whether it was an SMS or a phone call or a data connection, how long for. The physical handset, as we've been told, wasn't found.
Yep. No, thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate you clarifying that. And Kylie, great question. One of the things I love about the emails that we get sent is that it's often an opportunity for us to kind of like fill in little details around things like that so you can really understand kind of where we're getting this information from, how it's being presented to the court, all of that. So wonderful question. And Chris, a question here from Rachel in Perth. Rachel writes, hi, Chris and Stocky. Loving the pod despite the awful circumstances that has brought it to us. I guess this is more a question about semantics, but curious as to your wording at times. You're referring to the case as Rajwinder Singh's murder trial as opposed to Toya Cordingley's murder trial. And I'm wondering why this is, considering Toya was the one who was murdered.
For me, Rajwinder Singh is the one on trial. It's his trial. It's to determine whether or not there's evidence to find him guilty beyond reasonable doubt of her murder. I have seen it reported in various places as the Toya Cordingley murder trial, probably because her name is more recognisable in the community generally than Rajwinder Singh's. But yeah, for me, it is kind of just a matter of semantics rather than favouring one person over the other. But Rajwinder Singh is the man on trial, even if sometimes the evidence, you can go long tracks of evidence, through long tracks of evidence in court without hearing Rajwinder Singh's name or without hearing Toya Cordingley's name, which is, an interesting feature of covering cases like this where there are so many people whose movements are looked at.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that's sort of stuck with me over the last couple of days, Chris. I'm not sure we've heard Toya's name mentioned much at all in the last couple of days. And I mean, part of that is the reason that we've called this podcast series the Case of Toya's Murder. So, you know, her name is in that spot and it's a reminder of the reason we're here as well. And I mean, yeah, it is for me as well. The reason I say Rajwinder Singh's murder trial is because he is the man on trial for murder. In this case, it is the murder of Toya Cordingley that he's on trial for. So that's the reason that we framed it like that. But I mean, I think it's really important that you remember at the centre of this case, you know, is a young woman who was in her early 20s walking her dog on a beach on a Sunday afternoon. Something's a really normal part of her routine and she was murdered while she was doing that. So, I think it's a really great question, Rachel. I'm really glad you've asked that of us. And Chris, great answer as well. If you have any other questions, please get in touch. thecaseof@abc.net.au. Really do love hearing from you. And also, we're doing a little survey at the moment as well. So I'll put the link for that in the episode description for today. Really interested in finding out what you like about the case of, how you listen to it, what you want us looking into in the future as well. You know, the sort of things you'd like us to do on this podcast. So jump into that. It won't take you very long. It's only a handful of questions. So if you do that right now, because we both know that if you say you'll do it later, you probably won't. So if you jump into that right now, you can run through that, answer some of those questions while Chris Tester gives us the run through of what's coming up next.
I expect we'll hear more evidence about the forensics we touched on in this episode. We've heard about some things that were tested, but yet to hear evidence about what the results of some of that testing was. So plenty to stay tuned for regarding the forensic examination. And we're approaching the end of the third week. We were initially told that this was to be a 3-week trial. So all things running on track, we should be starting to get toward the end of the evidence part of this trial.
Thank you, Chris. Really appreciate you joining us for this episode of The Case of Toya's Murder and taking us through all of that. If you haven't clicked the link in the episode description yet to jump into our listener survey, please avail yourself of that. And we'll be back in your feed tomorrow, in fact, with another episode of The Case of the Easy Street Murders. Some huge developments in that committal hearing. So I'll be with Alexandra Alvaro to bring you all the latest in your feed tomorrow and then back with Chris Tester next Tuesday for The Case of Toya's Murder. The Case of Toya's Murder is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by ABC Far North reporter Chris Tester and me, Stephen Stockwell. Our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. And thank you to senior lawyer Jasmine Sims, our legal queen, for her legal advice, to the Queensland Newsroom and to Audio Studios manager Eric George. This episode was produced on the land of the Kimoi, Wallabarra, Yidinji and Wurundjeri people.